听力课堂，听 class.com。
Part 4. According to national labor law, workers in business and industry may by majority vote elect a union to negotiate their contracts and file grievances in their behalf. In more than half the states, once a union is voted in, one of two possible arrangements may exist. The unit of workers represented may become either a union or an agency shop.In the union shop, all employees are required to join the union. In the agency shop, employees may choose not to join. Nonetheless, they must pay all the fees to the union that union members pay. In theory, the fees are payment for union representation. They do not, however, differ from the cost of membership. Thus, there is little real difference between agency and union shop.In states with right-to-work laws, still another arrangement is possible. In an open shop, workers are not required to join the union elected to represent them, nor do they have to pay the union any fees. A move is currently underway to pass right-to-work laws in all states presently without them. Those in favor of such laws advance arguments focusing on individual freedom,and the need to make union leadership more responsive to the membership. A right-to-work law does not threaten the existence of unions, say many right-to-work campaigners. It simply forces unions to work effectively for their members. Unions must offer real benefits for the money they receive from workers. If they do not, workers will not support them with membership and money.No longer will union leaders be able to spend millions of dollars on political causes in which their membership has little interest. Right-to-work laws will force unions to concentrate, and properly so, on representing the interests of members to management. Individual workers will have a new measure of freedom under such laws. In fact, say those in favor of right-to-work laws,Workers should be permitted to decide to whom they will be responsible, union or management. Similarly, workers should not have to pay the sizable union membership fees against their will. Those who oppose right-to-work laws believe their purpose is to sap unions of their power. The laws, they insist, merely encourage free riders.Workers who contribute nothing to the cost of collective bargaining and representation, yet gladly accept the improved wages and fringe benefits these gain them. The financial burden on union members grows as the number of free riders increases. Worker morale is bound to suffer in an open shop situation. Opportunities of right-to-work laws are also concerned with the balance of power.Reduced union funding, they point out, will mean cutbacks in the labor lobby at all levels of government. Passage of laws to protect working people will then be harder to achieve. Big business lobbies will be able to steamroll legislation right over labor. A system of checks and balances on power is crucial to the survival of the U.S. as a free nation, say those opposed to right-to-work laws.Organized labor has served as an effective counterbalance to the powers of corporate giants. The labor movement must be strong to fight for and preserve workers' rights. Business is always ready, they insist, to exploit workers. They note, for instance, that some of the best contributors to a right-to-work campaign in Missouri were business owners fined for violating federal occupational health and safety standards.While both advocates and opponents frequently assume that so-called right-to-work laws weaken unions, there is little hard evidence to this effect. Two recent studies, in fact, indicate workers are no less likely to join unions in right-to-work states than in other states. Unit 12. B.
Part 1. A. With many technology jobs now being outsourced to other countries, the catchword is globalization, and the byproduct is job loss. Outsourcing refers to the shifting of middle-class jobs to nations such as India and China, where American companies can hire two employees for the same cost of hiring one employee in the United States. Brian D. McAndrew, superintendent of the county's vocational school district, explained that what is happening in the technology field is always being assessed at the high technology high school. The whole concept is to provide young people with an understanding of a career pathway. The curriculum at the high school level, no matter the subject, is more geared toward understanding the career area and all of its tentacles within the area. He said students are not being trained for a special job. They are being trained toward engineering, and who knows what engineering will be like in 10 years. They learn what the fields of engineering and technology are about so that they can make more intelligent choices as they move on to the next level, the superintendent said. McAndrew noted that the word outsourcing was not even part of the lexicon 10 years ago, and when it became a part of the language of business, it meant something else entirely. Originally, outsourcing was when a company contracted workers to come into its place, a business, he said. However, the definition of the word changed over time and now refers to jobs being placed outside the United States. First, we saw outsourcing going out of state and now out of the country. Because of technology, all you need is qualified people who are willing to work for less than American workers, McAndrew said.
B. 1. The job fair will present students with the opportunity to network with employers in health, pharmaceutical, biotech, legal, and other fields. 2. What we are faced with is a changing marketplace in which a person with a PhD no longer has only one career track. 3. Recognizing the ever-shifting job market, his university has invited companies in the industrial, consulting, and legal fields to campus for the job fair. 4. As our economy changes in an effort to stay competitive, certain types of work disappear permanently as a result. 5. Once viewed as a pathway to a new frontier, some young scientists describe their PhD education as a difficult road to nowhere. 6. All this has given rise to a substantial decline in the number of new employment opportunities in science in the United States. 7. The decline in the number of PhDs produced from 1970 to 1976 is in part attributed to the poor academic job market. 8. Students make their job choices based not on a rational assessment of the job market, but on various subjective factors. 9. Without reliable forecasts, you'll have to base your assessment of the job market on the experiences of your peers and on media reports. 10. This lends weight to the argument that people do not post-doc as a preferred choice, but that many regard it as the only realistic option.
Part 2. As far as Brian Hill's four kids are concerned, nothing has really changed. Dad still dons a suit and tie every morning and catches the 7:45 a.m. train to downtown Chicago, spends the day at a desk by a window on the 11th floor, and returns home to the leafy suburb of Winnetka in time for dinner and maybe a game of catch in the backyard. But the 40-year-old engineering exec has been out of work for 3 months now. His last job was with a small energy consulting firm. Now, his office is an outplacement center where he searches for work along with some 30 other professionals. Hill is relatively lucky. Down the hall, 58-year-old Mike Thompson has been looking for more than a year, often going months without landing even an interview. Hale is out there making the rounds and seems enthusiastic when potential employers tell him that his resume is great and that he shouldn't be on the street for long. His attitude is still good, and as Hale will tell you, that's more important than fancy degrees or work experience. Getting up every morning and going downtown helps me keep focused, says Hill after another day of working the phones and searching the net. My kids think I'm still working. My oldest knows I'm looking for a job, but not that I'm out of work.
Part 3, Passage 1. Students are often worried about writing a resume, and it's not uncommon to struggle with the task. But it doesn't have to be intimidating if you understand the goal of your resume, to generate interest and interviews. It simply has to pique the interest of the reader and answer the only question he cares about: will this candidate add value to my company? Of course, in order to demonstrate your value, you need to know what potential employers are looking for. Start by researching job postings that interest you. Look for frequently mentioned requirements. Ask experienced professionals what they consider important when they make hiring decisions. Once you know what is important to employers, you can target your resume to address those issues. Many students worry that they don't have enough experience to create a compelling resume. Don't be concerned. The content of your resume will be determined by your own unique experiences, skills, and background. The key is to emphasize those things that demonstrate how you will add value and to leave out those things that don't. Many people are surprised to learn that resume design is just as important as content, but it's absolutely true. It must be eye-catching and easy to read. To get ideas for layout and structure, study the resume books specifically written for students. As you work on your resume, bear in mind your reader's basic concern. If you answer effectively by highlighting relevant skills, personal characteristics, and accomplishments, your resume will open the right doors and generate interviews.
Passage 2. If you are prepared to lie on your resume, be prepared to get caught. Competition for jobs is becoming fiercer, and companies realize they have more options to choose from. Therefore, it is becoming more and more common for companies to do extensive background checks on your resume prior to an offer of employment. According to a recent survey, the most common misleading information being put on resumes is inflated titles, accomplishments, and salaries, inaccurate dates, half-finished degrees, inflated education or purchase degrees that do not mean anything, etc. A study shows that out of 100 companies, almost 95% said they would immediately eliminate the candidate from consideration if he claimed a degree where no degree was ever earned. It may be tempting to add an extra job responsibility or the amount of experience you have had in a particular area to grab your reader's attention. However, now you are faced with adequately discussing responsibilities that you never really had. If you do end up getting the job, you are stuck with more lying to the hiring manager, your co-workers, clients, customers, or even fans. You would have to show up to work every day knowing that you lied to get there and wondering when you might get caught. If you do get caught, the result is typically getting fired right on the spot. Now, you have a real reason to lie when you have to look for another job. Beware! Background checks might happen years after you were hired. So before you lie on your resume, think twice and know the potential consequences, not only financially, but it could also prove to be a huge source of embarrassment.
Passage 3. Employers are looking for self-starters, They want flexible workers. The dictionary defines flexible as the ability to adapt to new, different, or changing requirements. To be flexible, you need marketable skills. But you also need certain personality traits and the ability to do well in many situations, not just the workplace. Flexible people find it easier to achieve their goals because they have confidence and a positive attitude. They value creativity and independence. Furthermore, they usually work together with a network of friends and others. Flexible people feel secure about themselves. They can handle risk and uncertainty with few problems. In short, they adapt rapidly. These quick adapters will dominate the future workforce and are totally comfortable with technology. Flexible workers highly value professional relationships. They inform peers and supervisors of their accomplishments and skills. They network constantly and interact easily with colleagues from different cultural and racial backgrounds. They also see themselves in several roles at a time. For instance, as both a generalist who is able to take on many tasks and a specialist in a specific career area. Furthermore, flexible people are able to reshuffle their priorities when circumstances change. They may reevaluate their life priorities and reframe the situation positively. If British naturalist Charles Darwin, author of Origin of the Species, were still alive, this great thinker might say that the evolution of your career depends on your ability to survive. Will you be among the fittest, the most flexible to survive? Part 4. In the past 5 years, concern about the job market for research scientists has grown tremendously. Once the topic of hushed hallway conversations among graduate students and postdocs, reports of a dismal job market are now emblazoned across the pages of newspapers, magazines, and even the nightly news. Once viewed as an entree to an endless frontier, some young scientists describe their PhD education as an arduous road to nowhere. While there is a growing effort to gather more timely and precise data on the PhD job supply, young scientists' perceptions of the job market and their graduate school experiences have received relatively little attention. For example, is job market pessimism pervasive or confined to a few hard-hit disciplines? What is the role of the job market in students' decisions to enroll in graduate school or to drop out? Most important, what advice does the current population of new PhDs have for future students and for policymakers? To explore these issues, we surveyed job seekers at recent AGU meetings. Our findings confirm the general belief that job market pessimism is widespread in the community of young scientists and show that there is some variation in pessimism by sub-discipline. Survey respondents had many ideas for what they would have done differently in their graduate training. Most relate to broadening their experiences in order to have more employment options. With this research project, we strive to provide more discipline-specific data on the graduate school experiences and perceptions of geosciences students. We hope to provide information to students to help them make decisions about their graduate education and future careers, to faculty to help them become better advisors, and to institutional leaders to help them craft appropriate changes in graduate programs. It is our goal to continue to build a data set to monitor changing perceptions of the job market and experiences in graduate school in the geosciences. By surveying current job seekers, primarily graduate students and postdocs at the end of their training, we believe that we add an important voice to the policy debates. Several studies have documented converging events that have created a substantial decline in the number of new employment opportunities in science in the United States, though hard data on job supply are still lacking. In brief, financial restructuring both within academe and at the federal and state levels have curtailed research funding and reduced the number of available faculty positions. Concurrently, the number of doctorates granted in the physical sciences, including the earth, atmospheric, and marine sciences, has continued to rise. Consequently, there is enormous competition for few academic research positions, which is reflected in the large numbers of people entering postdoctoral fellowships. The 1995 survey of earned doctorates showed that over 50% of those earning PhDs in the physical sciences were headed to postdocs, the highest proportion ever. Many people choose to take a postdoc to broaden their skill base and to garner an edge in the job market. However, postdoc positions also serve as interim jobs in the absence of other options and effectively prolong the training period for students. Despite the dramatic changes in the economics of the research science job market, many decision makers are reluctant to tinker with the existing system, believing that students entering graduate school are making careful, reasoned decisions based on the state of the job market. They argue that students will react to the paucity of research jobs by entering graduate school in smaller numbers and leave seeking non-research science employment. There is evidence that this is broadly true on aggregated levels. The decline in the number of PhDs produced from 1970 to 1976 is in part attributed to the poor academic job market. The downturn in the number of humanities PhDs currently being awarded is also attributed to the poor academic job market, although the decline has not been proportional to the fall in demand. Unit 13. A.
Part 1. A. A newsletter is one of the easiest, low-cost ways to reach your customers, but they have to be produced right in order to be effective. The following is some advice on how to create a good newsletter. First, be creative when choosing a name for your newsletter. Most companies stick their newsletter with the same name as their company, but there are ways to improve its marketability. Example, your company's name is Joe's Tree Nursery. The treehouse has potential and makes your newsletter sound fun to read. Second, stay away from the sales hype. Your newsletter is supposed to be informative, not a booklet full of advertisements. If the stories in your newsletter are well written, consumers won't need to be told your products or services are better. They'll see it for themselves. Third, write in third person. All stories should be written as a third-party observer, and write in a conversational tone. That is, talk to your customer, not at them. Don't use big words when smaller ones will do. Try also to avoid technical jargon. Keep your stories on an even keel. Fourth, proofread your stories. Your newsletter is a reflection of your company, its quality, service, and people. Have several people proofread each story so you can have several perspectives. Last but not least, your front page should pack a punch. Put your best articles, the most informative ones, right on the front page. If you draw readers in, they're more likely to flip through the entire issue.
B. 1. Children here are too poorly equipped to think critically about the media that affect their lives. 2. Logging on to the internet is as fundamental to daily functioning as making a telephone call. 3. One advantage of electronic mail is that it is almost free when compared to fax and postal services. 4. Media education is required in Canada nationwide, through nearly all of Western Europe, and on the rise in Asia. 5. Gradually, we are making education more student-centered and more responsive to their real-world needs. 6. Several students have recently been punished for plagiarism and cheating through the Internet. 7. With the help of search engines, people can locate and buy products and services from all over the world. 8. They placed a well-designed advertisement for teachers of English in a local newspaper. 9. No company can afford costly advertising mistakes. Translation mistakes are at the heart of many blunders in international advertising. 10. In designing advertisements for other countries, messages need to be short, simple, and without jokes.
Part 2. The financing and structure of public broadcasting varies widely across Europe. Some broadcasters are financed almost entirely by license fees or taxes. Others rely entirely on commercial money. Still others, particularly in Southern Europe, are a hybrid, accepting financing from both sources. Germany provides the biggest amount of public financing, 6.6 billion euros, $8.4 billion last year, for the broadcasters ARD and ZDF, which also obtained some of their money from commercial means. To some private investors who are vying with public networks for viewers, that is unfair competition. But with more than 40% market share, public television remains popular in Germany, and proposals to overhaul the system radically have not gotten far. In France, however, the fear of privatization has been dangled at France 2 and at Radio France, the public radio system, where journalists went back to work over the weekend after a 5-week strike over pay. After all, the government sold off TF1 in 1987, and it leads France 2 by a wide margin in the ratings race. Until recently, the BBC was seen by many analysts as a model of how a public broadcaster could adapt to a more competitive commercial setting. It maintains a vast production operation, employing tens of thousands of Britons. And the previous leadership moved to expand in areas such as children's broadcasting, digital archive services, and the Internet.
Part 3, Passage 1. Can small businesses be persuaded to pay for online advertising, even if they do not sell their products or services on the web? That is a big question for Internet companies like Google and Yahoo, as well as Yellow Pages publishers like Verizon and SBC, which are stepping up their efforts to sell online ads to plumbers, dry cleaners, and other small businesses, most of which do not have websites. A survey released last week suggests that small businesses may not be able to ignore online advertising for long because potential customers are looking for them on the Internet. The Kelsey Group, a research and advisory firm, and BizRate.com, a shopping comparison service, queried more than 5,500 online shoppers and found that 25% of their searches were for merchants located near their homes or workplaces. The figure, more than twice what the Kelsey Group had estimated last year, is particularly striking, because search engines and Yellow Pages websites have done little until recently to give Internet users easy ways to find local businesses. But the lack of local search advertising is likely to change soon, Internet advertising analysts said. According to a report released last week by eMarketer, online search advertising revenues in the United States will reach $2.5 billion this year, and $3 billion next, and local search advertising will capture at least 15% of that market. As money moves into that part of Internet advertising, Internet companies are quickly improving their services.
Passage 2. Marketing on the Internet is not really a choice anymore, but has almost become a necessity in today's marketplace. No company can afford to ignore the fact that online marketing is now a multi-billion dollar business. Those businesses without an active online presence are missing out on a goldmine of potential customers. Some businesses fail to appreciate the revenue potential of internet marketing. Others simply fear change or think internet marketing too complicated and hope that it will go away. Unfortunately for them, internet marketing is growing every day. Here are some reasons why businesses should have an active online presence. First, competition between the small businesses and the larger ones is changing. In bygone days, a small business usually lacked the resources of their larger competitors. Now, even a small business can access much of the same technology as the giant corporations. They too can use autoresponders, accept online payments, and even deliver products over the internet. Second, with a professionally designed website, it's now easy for a small business on the internet to have the appearance and credibility of being a large corporation. Third, compared to other media, the internet enables a business to advertise at considerably lower prices. It may not be a replacement for other marketing, but the internet is generally cheaper than advertising on television, radio, or newspapers, magazines, and even by direct mail. Finally, by automating a website, a business can be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No extra staff costs and no overtime rates to pay.
Passage 3. Media literacy is the ability to access, understand, analyze, evaluate, and create media messages on television, the internet, and other outlets. It can help us interpret the many messages we daily receive from these sources. By applying the same critical thinking skills used in reading and writing to other forms of media. Many Americans get most of their news and other information from the electronic media. Yet, until recently, children have not been taught how to thoughtfully examine media messages. A growing number of educators and media professionals have called for media literacy to be taught in schools, and it has now become part of the curricular frameworks in all 50 states. Medical organizations and child advocacy groups recommend parents and caregivers take an active role in helping children become media literate. Media literacy and digital ethics go hand in hand. Digital ethics is all about teaching ethical, courteous, safe, and productive behavior while using digital media. Any kind of media can be used well or misused by those who make it and by those who use it. One approach would be to restrict students' use of media and try to prevent them from being exposed to any potential negative effects. A better alternative would be to take a proactive approach by teaching them how to make the best use of these resources while avoiding the pitfalls. Digital ethics is more than simply an acceptable use policy. Also known as cyber ethics or cyber citizenship, it is defined by the U.S. Department of Justice as a code of safe and responsible behavior for the Internet community. Students practicing digital ethics use media appropriately and respect their own and others' privacy and property. Part 4. Ads bring about a threat to physical, emotional, social, and cultural well-being. Because we live in a market-driven economy, advertising flows constantly, from television to billboards to print ads to blinking internet messages to elevator rides. In the early 1970s, the daily number of ads targeted at the average American was 560. By 1999, this number jumped to 3,000, and the number is astonishingly high now. It is affecting our health. Advertising can affect our health mainly in four aspects: physical health, emotional health, social health, and cultural health. First, advertising and physical health. Ads for junk food, tobacco, and liquor encourage unhealthy choices. In 1998, researchers found that TV commercials lowered children's ability to resist the temptation for low-nutrition food. This was 15 years after a study which concluded that sports celebrities in TV and magazine ads promoting the use of snuff and chewing tobacco led to increased numbers of young people using these products. Other research found that ads for alcohol became increasingly salient and attractive to kids between the ages of 10 and 14 years. Second, advertising and emotional health. Advertising has long appealed to young adults' acute awareness of physical appearance and sexuality. Appeals to sexuality have long been used to sell shampoo, cigarettes, cosmetics, television programs, films, clothing, liquor, soft drinks, and cars. As to physical appearance, according to psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, youth who are surrounded by media images of sleek beauty can develop emotional problems, ranging from feelings of inferiority to eating disorders to suicide. Third, advertising and social health. Advertisers bombard us with powerful messages reflecting values, attitudes, and ideologies that will not always benefit social and environmental health. These include, but are not limited to, valuing appearance over substance, instant satisfaction over delayed satisfaction, action over reflection, consumption over frugality and recycling, competition over cooperation, and materialism over spirituality. According to Patricia M. Greenfield's Mind and Media, adolescent boys who watch television were more focused on what they would have in the future, while adolescent boys without television were more focused on what they would be doing. The longer the child's experience with television, the more this materialistic outlook increased. Others found that ads not only encouraged youngsters to adopt materialistic attitudes, but also caused friction between parents and children, which limited the development of kids' moral and ethical values. Fourth, advertising and cultural health. How media portrays or represents sex, race, age, and social class can affect viewers' attitudes and actions toward that group. The United Nations Commission on the Status of Women summarized three ways in which women in ads are stereotyped. They are usually portrayed as unable to think for themselves, waiting for men to make decisions. Loss of male approval is viewed as a threat, since the advertised products are used to gain approval from men. And women seem to be obsessed with cleanliness, expressing a gamut of emotions in embracing whiteness, brightness, and freshness. This report concluded that most commercials with voiceovers are spoken and sung by men. Males appear more frequently and in more roles than females, and women are more often shown in family roles inside the house, while men are shown outdoors. And finally, physical, emotional, social, and cultural health are not the only ones affected by the cycle of advertising and consuming. Advertising also helps weaken the health of our natural environment. At the end of the cycles of advertising consumption lie heaps of paper, plastic, petroleum, and other resources. We cannot escape paying the price for all these.